This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, I'm Shahad Kutun. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. It is the 10th of April, 2018, and we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of interviews, views, and analysis. Now, remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Remember, put your name there so that we know who you are. Let's begin with some news that came overnight. We had that victory in Hungary yesterday. Viktor Orban expected to win, but with a reduced majority, didn't in fact do that. He came in with a stronger mandate. And now some Europeans are saying we need to take his message very seriously.
All right. So you were saying he campaigned on the kind of anti-immigration, anti-EU. So again, parties like Marine Le Pen in France were probably celebrating his re-election, wasn't it?
Yeah, look, Viktor Orban, right? That's his name. He's been championing this, what he calls, illiberal democracy. That's according to the newstatesman.com. Illiberal democracy, you know, praising the likes of Trump and Putin, etc. So he's following in that ilk. He sees himself as the defender of a Christian Europe, but it looks like the folks over there in Germany are saying, well, you know, this troubled relationship with Hungary, that needs to be re-looked at.
Yeah, in fact, what I think they're trying to do is not to push back on Hungary and deny the message. They're saying we need to engage more seriously with the concerns that Hungary has. I think that seems to be the message coming from this particular German minister. Now, moving away from that and speaking of Trump, Wall Street apparently rising on tweets that suggest that tensions between China and the U.S. are not about to boil over. That helped Wall Street pick up a little, but it did lose something on reports that the FBI raided the office of a lawyer involved in the Stormy Daniels case.
So this is Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. And this was a referral by special counsel Robert Mueller to raid the office. And I was just wondering, you know, because markets will seesaw, right? You know, it'll go up and down in the space of a day. So, yeah. Talks about a trade war will make markets fall, investors nervous. And then, you know, officials saying, well, actually, it's not that bad, and the markets will go up again. And then the Donald Trump lawyers gets raided, his office gets raided, and the markets will seesaw again. So not anything new, but I'm interested to see where this would go with the whole Stormy Daniels issue.
Yeah, well, and also looking at market reaction, you know, whether this is just a knee-jerk reaction, you know, and like you rightly pointed out, Mel, a lot of times these headline risks kind of cool off and then nothing really comes out of it, right? But what it does signal to the market is that volatility that is firmly back in the game. I think so far this year, more than 6 days, trading days on the S&P 500 has resulted in intraday reversals of over 1%. So looks like volatility
and that's substantial, right?
Yeah.
1% substantial.
In the same day.
Yeah. I have to say, though, the headlines coming out from this has been quite clickbaity. I thought I saw something as the Stormy in a teacup and then the calm before the Stormy. I tell you, they can take it anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, the thing, I guess, is whether the president and the presidency, as it were, is going to be distracted by all this. And I think that's perhaps something of concern, that, you know, his legislative agenda or his ability to understand what's going on in the world, especially as he's really concentrated so much of power and decision-making in himself, right? I mean, we've seen what he's done with Rex Tillerson and the State Department. It really, everything comes out from him and his 240-character tweets.
Well, it is expanded to 249.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, the Trump trade of 2018 versus the Trump trade of 2017, very, very different. You know, so I guess we'll have to wait and see how the rest of 2018 pans out.
Okay. And a quick look at the war crimes prosecutor from the International Criminal Court. He's asking for the court to decide whether he has jurisdiction over the case of the deportation, the mass deportation of Rohingya from Myanmar to Bangladesh.
I believe the prosecutor is a woman.
Oh, so I'm sorry. The name is unfamiliar.
The name is unfamiliar. But it is interesting to see why this case will – just the case, the nature of this case, because Bangladesh is a member of the ICC. Myanmar is not. So in this kind of cross-jurisdiction, it's the first of its kind, and it will be interesting to see.
And also the well-being of the 700,000 Muslim Rohingya who have fled their homes into Bangladesh. I think ultimately the concern is over their well-being.
Yeah, we'll be back with a look at the statement made by Thor director Taika Waititi that New Zealand is a racist. We'll be back. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, River Deep Mountain High by the Supremes and the Four Tops. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han, and the Morning Run continues. I just wanted to say before we carry on that this is the 40th anniversary of the movie Grease, of the original Grease.
Really? Yeah.
You know, we had Stockard Channing and a range of notables. Olivia Newton-John, for starters.
Is that why you have your tight leather pants on this morning?
I was about to say.
Too bad it's radio.
Luckily, it's radio. Okay, we'll get to tight pants later and a certain minister. Let's stay on the story about the filmmaker, or a Kiwi filmmaker, New Zealand filmmaker, Taika Waititi. I think I'm getting his name right. He's described New Zealand, his native country, as a racist place. And he did so in a magazine called Dazed and Confused.
So if Taika Waititi, if that name sounds familiar to you, he directed Thor, the Thor Ragnarok, the one that was freakishly funny, the one that was recently released. He also directed Flight of the Conchords,
yes,
which was also so good and funny. So he's quite a noted filmmaker. But I guess so because of that, what he said in this interview really, I guess, rubbed some people the wrong way, saying that the type of racism he faced in New Zealand was that he described it as people just flat out refused to pronounce Maori names properly.
Mm. And I think the proper since you're all about trying to pronounce names properly, I think it's supposed to be Maori, I think.
Is it? Maori.
Because my cousin's wife in New Zealand, she kind of has some Maori blood in her.
Ah. Anyways, okay, so Maori, Pakeha. Maori. Okay, yeah. But I don't think the expectation is on people like us, right? People who are not from New Zealand. The issue really is with fellow New Zealanders who haven't, despite hundreds of years of cohabitation on the islands of New Zealand, bothered to understand native languages or even give them the due respect.
So do you think that just mispronouncing names can be considered casual racism?
I think not taking the effort to, you know, especially like Sharad pointed out, you know, given that there has been this cohabitation, but I think the Kiwi society has kind of developed a lot more than just cohabitating, right? I will say that during my time, I spent a few months in New Zealand, you know, did a few gigs here and there. I actually found it to be the contrary, though, whereby the pendatang over there, and I'm using air quotes, right, you know, actually made it an effort to really integrate with the Maori culture, be it, say, the naming of towns, the naming of cities, you know, with infrastructure, you know. So I think it's very much integrated, at least relatively speaking.
Okay, so that's not the only example it gives, right? The mispronunciation of names is one thing. It's also a racial profiling. It says that if you are seen as Polynesian, you get picked out of the crowd and such. But the issue for us is that as visitors, we're always impressed by the use of native names and such. Mm. But it's the locals that know the nuances. They're the ones, and you look at the story and the things that are said, right, about native Pakeha relations or Maori Pakeha relations. It's maybe a bit more nuanced. Maybe they pick it up that we don't.
What kind of nuances? I guess, as an outsider, don't really understand.
So one example that's given in the story, and we'll tweet that out, is of a guy who says, well, he got a phone call. He was, you know, an operator. And the person says to him, why are Maori living in the cities? They used to live in the countryside and didn't bother anybody.
I would like to think that's the outlier.
Kind of racist. That's outright racist, don't you think?
Yeah. What's interesting is that this interview has now sparked a conversation in New Zealand about where their society is going and the kind of racism that does, in fact, exist.
Right. Look, I love New Zealand. So to kind of give the other side to that comment, that outright racist comment that was quoted by Sharad there's this other side of the of the response as well. Okay, and this is quoted in a story as well on BBC, and it comes from the curator of the People of New Zealand Twitter account, and it says this, and I quote, and I love this. Okay, there will always be work to do, and the only way to get better is to acknowledge it. Does not matter if we aren't the worst. We can still do better. I think that's a very healthy perspective on this, right? You know, on one hand, it's not, you know, washing yourself off of any form of blame, but it's recognizing that, hey, despite New Zealand's standing, despite the level of integration in New Zealand society, there's always room for improvement. And
that could be applied anywhere, right?
Right.
And to be fair to the filmmaker, he does, in fact, make the point that he thinks New Zealand is the best country in the world, despite its problems. He's clearly a patriot, but patriotism doesn't mean you take off your thinking hat and store it in a closet away from, you know, the glare of the sun, as it were.
I think the claim of New Zealand being the best country in the world, now that one should be right for debate.
Aha. Okay, we'll be back with a debate on a catchy new youth-orientated video by the Minister for Youth, Khairi Jamaluddin. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Don't Stand So Close to Me by The Police. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. And the Morning Run continues. It's the 10th of April, 2018. Remember, we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning. You can always join in the conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Now, we turn our attention to the fact that we're in that season to be jolly.
Which season is that?
It's the election season.
Season for giving.
All of the above.
In fact, I think this is a season which lines are drawn in the sand. And in fact, today, the Elections Commission is going to be having a meeting. They're having this meeting this morning, and by noon or so, we'll get the dates for nomination day and polling day. So just keep yourself tuned to the latest developments in terms of GE. Well, let's turn to a story that actually is also related to the general election, which is a new video out by Barisan Youth, which unveils it's a youth manifesto, at least give us a peek into the youth manifesto.
Yeah, that's because later today, Barisan Youth is going to be unveiling its manifesto specifically targeted to youth. So yesterday, Youth and Sports Minister Khairi Jamaluddin gave us a bit of a teaser on social media about a campaign. It was a campaign video targeted to the youth. It was about 3 minutes long. And I watched it. I'm sure you guys have watched it too. It's gone, I think, it's been shared quite a fair bit on social media. And it's essentially what looks like a one-take shot of Khairi going to different... I say Khairi like he's my friend, but, you know, the minister going on to... caretaker minister now, isn't he?
Yeah.
Going on to different sets, talking about the different things that BN Youth will provide for youth. So including jobs and upskilling and even, I guess, help to buy your first home and to get married and have kids.
Right. To be fair to you, Melissa, well, he introduces himself as KJ.
Shall we just call him KJ then?
KJ.
Let's go KJ.
But I will say this though, in terms of production quality, it is a far cry from the videos that came out of the BN camp during GE13. Do you guys remember that infamous karaoke video with MCA?
So meaning it's better than that.
Oh, it's way better.
What I was struck by was his the way he held his body, where he comported his body. He kind of jumps up and he has this really strange kind of walk.
Really?
You know, kind of a hippity hop thing. And everybody
it's
actually...
It's called energy, Sharad.
I know. And in fact, this is a video that people over 40 might want to avoid because it, you know, makes them feel a little sad, reminiscing back to the days when they did have energy. I just want to say that everybody in that video hippity hops.
Okay, so again, the demographic for the young and the energetic, and I guess, you know, he's trying to appeal to, you know,
hippity hoppers,
a dynamic crowd. And the language that he uses also, you know, kind of like, hey guys, you know, very casual. I also thought it was interesting the way it referenced a lot of what's happening, kind of timely. There was a reference to crispy skin chicken, you know, so all those things with Rendanggate, trying to, I guess, and the question is, would that make for an effective campaign video?
Well, I think there are limitations, because I think when it comes to all these messaging coming out of the political camps, the idea is, well, perhaps not the idea, well, the idea is to reach as broad an audience as possible, but I think the effect really is to reinforce biases that are evident on either side already, right? So I really doubt whether these kind of videos can actually sway or persuade voters' mindsets.
Yeah, which is really interesting, because one of the dilemmas going into this general election is this concern that there is a demographic that is in some ways turned off by politics as a demographic, and it's a youth demographic that's essentially urban, that doesn't see it, cannot relate to either side of the divide, right? So they do have concerns. But do they watch a video like this or listen to political messaging and say, yes, that side or that side have an answer for us?
Well, I guess it really kind of boils down to what... So that was, for me, the question, right? Was this an attempt to make BN youth look more engaging, more responsive to the concerns of the youth? Or was it like a whole laundry list of promises? Because, you know, when you actually watch the entire video, that was what it was. It was a laundry list of one set to another of promises being made to the youth. And I'm wondering, I guess, you know, young people are smarter than just wanting promises. They want to feel connected or feel like they're part of something. And I wonder whether this message or this video actually achieved that goal of feeling, making the young feel like they're participating in democracy.
Right. I mean, also recognizing that these videos are then put out there, you know, it is one of a myriad of influences that actually go towards, you know, helping someone formulate a mindset or worldview, right? So it's friends, family, presence and authority, and also these videos, right? So, you know, given all these influences, really, what will be the net result? Will it be a vote for Pakatan? Will it be a vote for BN? Will it be a vote for PAS? You know, who knows? But at least I think it's important to list it all for this key target demographic, because according to Merdeka Center, right, over 2.4 million voters going to GE14, at least the eligible ones, are actually those under the age of 30. So they represent 2/3 of the electorate come
GE14. Not 2/3, really.
The under 30s form 2/3 of the 3.7 million.
Yeah. Well, okay, we'll come back to those numbers. But, you know, again, back to the video and the hippity hopping. There's a moment in which people, they're protesters, they're wearing black, and they're saying, well, we want this, we want that. And then something is said, and one of them has their T-shirts ripped off their bodies.
What?
And yes, but he's got another T-shirt underneath. Okay. And it says,
calm down, Melissa.
And he says, Gaji Nae. Gaji Nae. And of course, then he has a big smile on his face and he hippity hops away.
Right.
If it was, like I say, there is a lot of hippity hopping going on.
Okay.
And everybody is young and everybody seems to be very healthy, especially if you look at that couple, you know, the whole you can buy a house, we'll help you buy your first house. Oh. They, at least the husband did, have significant developed biceps and triceps.
Is that what you were focusing on?
No, I was just saying, he was, you know, the clothes lend for that.
I just want to very quickly bring up, so in comparison, I also saw another campaign video coming from the opposite side. I think it was a Dr. Mahathir video, which was, you know, was him reciting a Malay poem, a sajak, and then, you know, with a really heart-tugging music in the background. So that, I think, went for a different approach, trying to play on people's emotions. Him saying, oh, I'm about to leave now. I mean, what? I'm not long for this world, or something. I'm paraphrasing here. But so that, for me, that really made me ask the question, so what kind of campaign videos are effective? And some may be targeted to the youth, some may be targeted to someone older and not so hippity-hop.
Well, I guess, you know, very contrasting emotions there. On one hand, you know, one is on nostalgia, okay, well, especially the case with Tun Dr. Mahathir. Another one's perhaps forward-looking.
Okay, we'll be back after the break with a look at an influencer, Wardina Safia, and her political leanings. Taking you to the first bulletin in the morning is Incubus with Are You In? Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes. I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han and Melissa Idris. And the morning run continues. It's the 10th of April. And remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. Thank you very much, Sharm Flint, author of Inspector Singh Investigates and many other children's books, for your tweet this morning.
It's a wonderful series.
It's a wonderful series there. Melissa Idris, you know, giving you her and endorsement.
Yeah, it's the books to read list 2018.
Children's books.
It's a children's book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a.
You're a bit old for that, aren't
but
you?
But it's for all ages of society.
Oh dear.
We can all get something from it. All right, well, let's take a look at Wydeena Safia.
Yeah, so speaking about comments being made on social media, you've got former TV star Wydeena Safia of Spana Jaya fame, who has openly declared that she will not be supporting BN in the 14th general election. Now, in her own words, she says, and I quote, "No, I'm not afraid to say that my support is not for BN. I do not have to suck up to anyone for jobs." Can I say that? I guess I did. Nor do I have to be on TV anymore. So these kind of comments implies that, you know, support for BN could risk your career.
Or a lack of support for the ruling party. So basically, your lack of support for whoever is in power will affect your ability to operate as a professional. The idea is, so it could be even in the state of Penang, for instance. So if you were somebody who didn't approve of policies of the Lim Guan Eng administration and you said that openly, would you then be out in the cold? I mean, so it could apply to Penang or Selangor, where the Pakatan is in power, or at the federal level.
I do have to say, though, I mean, these comments coming from Wardina, look, she's a name in the local entertainment industry, but she's no longer actively in the local entertainment industry. I mean, she's now in Australia, if I'm not mistaken. She's living in Australia.
But what's important about her, Melissa, is that at some point, the government of Malaysia actually recognized her as an influencer and drew her into the Consultative Committee on National Unity. They wanted a youth voice. They wanted somebody with huge social media influence. And she had over 300,000 followers on Twitter at that point, if I remember correctly. But and so she was used by politicians and policymakers to push their agenda. Now she's kind of pushing back and dissing them.
Right, and if I may be vulnerable for a moment here, Wardina Safia definitely had a huge amount of influence on a 15-year-old Han.
Oh,
she was the main reason I watched Spana Jaya, okay? if I may say.
She's very pretty.
Yeah. But the idea is this, right? Because you've got local entertainers, celebrities, who then perhaps face reputational risk or even career risks when they actually step into the political arena. Well, not just actively, but also just making commentary. We saw how Sheila Majid, right, just a few months ago, she also walked into this whole firestorm given her politically slanted comments online.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because since Sheila Majid tweeted, she tweeted out something about the weaker ringgit, expensive food and the scarcity of jobs. And she said those are the real kind of bread and butter issues that Malaysians should be worrying about. And from there, there's something now called the Sheila Majid test. So to hold politicians to account, if they talk about these three things that Sheila Majid mentioned in her tweet, therefore you should be paying attention because they're actually responding to issues on the ground.
Well, you know, the issue is, and we were talking about the director of Thor just now. I mean, they might be in, you know, entertainment, they might have a particular persona, but they're also citizens of their own countries and they have a right as any other citizen. What I think is also in play is a sense of a personal responsibility. If you become an influencer and you're being used and have been in the past to advance an agenda, national unity is an agenda that everybody can sort of line up behind, then why not use that influence to shape the conversation that's happening in your country at that point in time? Sheila Majid Act was not, it was not about being politically slanted. It was something, it was publicly spirited. Well, tell us what you think of celebrities, you know, voicing their opinions on the politics of the day. You can always tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. We come back with a look at voters from the Chinese community. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Have you ever seen The Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival or CCR? I'm Shahad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. What a Muhiba lot we are. We don't even realize
it. Not by design. And that's the best thing, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Now, speaking about ethnic identity, polls, of course, are looming. And today, the Elections Commission is having a meeting in the morning. And we expect an announcement about the dates of nomination day and polling day today by noon sometime today. Now, what's very important is that people, especially political analysts, look at Malaysian politics as essentially driven by ethnic differences or tensions, and that's been true of much of our history. The question is, how do ethnic communities vote? They obviously don't vote in one mind. They're made up of individuals, but there are certain patterns. Now, to start looking at who shapes those patterns of political behavior, of course, we turn immediately to political parties. And we're looking today at the Malaysian Chinese Association. And we look at what's going to happen in this election, considering how difficult a time they had over the last two general elections. Now, to understand the dynamics better, we spoke to Dr. Ku Ying-hui. She's a senior lecturer at the Department of International and Strategic Studies at University of Malaya. And she shares her thoughts on the question of the MCA.
Well, in the past, there's this sentiment that MCA and MIC that fought for independence from British rule together with UMNO, and then they have been proven as loyal and trusted partner of UMNO in the Barisan Nasional since we achieved our independence. So the MCA, for example, is seen as to be championing the Chinese interests and rights. But over time, this particular sentiment has changed based on several factors. For example, back in GE13, Barisan Nasional had blamed the Chinese tsunami for Barisan Nasional's poor performance. And recently, with the passing of the redelineation report, where 129 parliamentarians voting in favor and 80 voting against it, and then there are so many talks about how unfair the gerrymandering is being done, together with the issues of the anti-fake news law that has been passed hastily despite protests from the opposition lawmakers and also the civil society groups. All these points, people might question, where's the voices of MCA and MIC? Are they not objecting to it, or are they not fighting for the Chinese rights for the MCA or the Indian rights for the MIC? So I think both parties, whether to the question of are they still significant in this GE14, I think it is becoming insignificant.
So based on that, how accurately can we make assumptions about voting habits based on ethnicity alone? Well, Dr. Ku thinks it's not as simple.
I believe every vote matters. And I do not think we should actually make a voting pattern based on ethnicity alone, as I think that would be too simplified. And it is important for us to consider other factors, such as the cost of living, corruption, poor governance, the country's image in terms of regionally and internationally. And also, ethnicity does not really matter when it comes to urban or maybe suburban seats. People are more politically aware, and I believe the voters will be able to actually make a good judgment on where the vote goes to.
And who can forget the infamous question posed to the Chinese community just after GE13? So we ask that same question to Dr. Ku. Apa lagi Cina mau?
I think the issues that Chinese voters are concerned with are still very much consistent with the past issues, such as cost of living, businesses, and education. But of course, from time to time, nowadays, I think Chinese voters also demand for clean and good governance, because it plays a very important role in terms of making sure the check and balance is being kept. It is a huge concern for the Chinese.
That was Ku Ying-hui, a senior lecturer at the Department of International and Strategic Studies at University of Malaya, with her thoughts on how the Chinese community might vote this time round, and also just dynamics within political parties that seek to represent their interests.
Right, as the Chinese in the room here.
Don't laugh,
you don't look at that. Anyways, look, so, on one hand, we've just heard Dr. Ku talk about how voting along racial Alliance, that is slowly waning, right? These concerns are becoming more broad-based. Yet when asked the question, like we just heard in the last clip, she talks about, you know, Chinese voters, say, wanting to deal with the cost of living, business, education, the demand for clean and good governance. Aren't those concerns shared by, you know, dare we assume, all Malaysians, regardless of their race, right?
Yeah, so that point about whether we can make assumptions, whether people will still vote based on their ethnicity, is that one that will apply in the next general elections? I think she was right to make the point that after what was dubbed the Chinese tsunami, there was a lot of, I think, goodwill lost for MCA after that comment.
Well, you know, recently Syed Saddiq of Bersatu came out to say that, and this was the headline, that race politics is here to stay. Mm-hmm. And I want to refer to another Bersatu member, because somebody who's a regular voice on BFM until recently, because it's Wan Saiful Wan Jan, who, when he did his public appearance recently and I moderated a discussion, there were a lot of people who considered that, why did he choose to enter politics through a party that had, you know, that was ethnic based,
right,
rather than, you know, go with what everybody assumes is the more progressive view, which is to sort of move beyond politics. And it's a very complex question. And then he says, you know, it's one of the more intractable parts of Malaysian politics. And for him, the important point was to reach out to a particular demographic and seek that transformation.
Right, because, you know, especially when it comes to elections, we tend to find a comfort in similarities, right? You vote along those same lines. And very often, given the dynamics evident in Malaysian society, we, you know, do share a lot of commonalities with those of our own race, right? And you see those sentiments being played out, especially when defending vernacular schools, for example, or, you know, defending certain rights. I think we recall this past Chinese New Year when we were having these discussions on air, there were threats about not being so overt with your show of the Year of the Dog. And that kind of statement stoked up sentiments that, hey, you know, we are Chinese first. We need to be able to show our Chinese identity loud and proud.
But at what point do we move away from this kind of race-based politics? If it's naive to think that, you know, we can't do it right now, here and now, are we at least taking baby steps so that in the future we move away from it?
Yeah, well, you know, this is the thing. If you look at Europe, right, and its history of democracy, we just had the story of the win in Hungary, Viktor Orban,
yes.
Yeah, and that claiming, you know, that he was defending a Christian Europe. I mean, that itself is about mobilizing people on the basis of identity. And right. I don't think identity politics will ever go away.
Right, especially when politicians prey upon the insecurities of people. You know, always, there seems to be this common message about how, you know, this particular demographic is under threat by foreign forces. That narrative appeals
That's
so well.
That's a post-truth narrative, isn't it? Playing on feelings over facts.
Hey, apalagi Cina Mau, quick answer. Apalagi you ada.
Wow.
Okay, taking us to the top of the hour is Justin Towns Earl with Maria. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Melissa Idris and Tan Chung Han. And the morning run continues to the 10th of April 2018. It's just after 7 minutes past seven in the morning. And remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio, WhatsApping us 018-789-8899. Of course, we've been talking about the elections because elections are in the air, and we'll know today, later today. If you didn't know, the Elections Commission is actually having a meeting this morning to decide on nomination and polling day. So by noon, if you listen to the BFM Bulletin, you'll be able to get the latest news on when polls will be.
So initially, this was supposed to be a meeting to set the date to discuss the meeting for this, right? But now it's the actual
meeting.
Date.
What's happened is the Election Commission usually has a press conference. They tell the public when that meeting is going to happen, but they decided to just alert the press through some notification, and they're going straight into the meeting this morning.
So efficient.
They are. It's interesting to see whether the dates for elections, a lot of people speculating an early May election, it might actually be even sooner. If that's possible, maybe that's the end of the month. But we don't know when we'll know for sure by the end of the day.
I think Han wants it to be helpful. failed yesterday.
Correct.
I don't know.
Should have happened yesterday. Oh my gosh.
No, you know, this is too important. It doesn't happen often enough. In many countries, people go and make decisions on a more regular basis because power is devolved and there's many different levels and you can participate. We need more participation, not less. We certainly don't want to wish it away just because it's disruption.
But what a delicate balance trying to manage people's fatigue over these elections, yet at the same time, getting people excited and feeling empowered to do something.
Yeah.
Right, because if you check out podcasts from the Morning Run from this time last year, we've been talking about GE14, okay? I mean, I guess that is the nature of, you know, what the political system that we inherited from the British. So there's this large amount of uncertainty, like the US, where you know, like clockwork, every 4 years it's going to happen, right? So it's, I was making those comments based on the level of political fatigue that is evident among the
Indonesian
electorate.
Well, I don't know about fatigue, but it does seem extraordinary to claim fatigue when we have so little, so few opportunities to actually make decisions, unlike more mature democracies. Are we ever going to aspire to a more mature democracy? You're going to have to actually participate even more. Well, okay, we turned our attentions to the party manifestos. Both coalitions have come out with their manifestos. And we spoke to Ibrahim Sufyan, because he's the founder of the independent pollster Merdeka Center, about how he views those elements in the manifestos. And he sees, in many ways, especially coming off after the Barisan Nasional manifesto launch over the weekend, whether this is essentially an extension of a business as usual for governments, exception kind of policy continuity for those governments?
Well, the manifesto has some interesting bits, particularly in terms of how they have carved out specific promises to the different states in the country. Some of the promises are quite interesting and builds upon the expectations of the voters there. You know, for example, the promise of building that highway from Gua Musang to Kota Baru. That has been, I suppose, talked about before, but that is something that I think will excite voters and something that really fits into the things that they need. The other promises in terms of raising the minimum wage, promising financial aid for students and expanding the BRIM coverage as well as the amount, I think those will be quite attractive to people. But the question is, how far will such promises, you know, create a bump or an increase in the level of support at this quite late stage of the season.
But some analysts have commented that there appears to be a lack of institutional reform in the manifesto. And here's what Ben has thinks about that.
Yes, I think I agree with that. The manifesto doesn't illustrate or doesn't flesh out a lot of the structural issues that government critics have leveled at the government in the past. I think about the only thing where they have talked about something structural is about reducing the dependence on foreign labor. But beyond that, a lot of it is listing out and promising to dole out goodies to the voters. That seems to be the theme of this election.
Now, one of the highlights in the manifesto is the improved BRIM program, giving out 1,500 ringgit to college students. We asked Ben if he thinks this is a game changer of sorts for BN.
Well, I think the proof will be in the pudding. That certainly will be of interest to many parents in the country in order to meet the cost of educating their children. That has already been in place in Selangor for several years now. And that has, I think, been well received in voters in Selangor. So if that is amply advertised, that might be of interest to voters. But I think what we've noticed, at least in the chatter, in social media, and also talking to people, is the expansion of BRIM from you know, whatever it is now to 2,000 ringgit. That, I think, is of interest to them, as well as the raise to be given to civil sector employees.
Because the other thing that observers note is that the themes in this year's manifesto or this for this upcoming general election are essentially the same as it was in GE13. So transportation, housing, infrastructure for East Malaysia. The question is, and this is what we asked Ben, if he thinks Malaysians reflect on campaign promises of the past and take stock of the progress of those promises.
Well, I think based on the work that we've done, people do reflect somewhat in terms of the track record of the contesting parties, particularly those in government because they are in power and they are supposed to deliver on those promises. What we've noticed is that campaign promises form only one part of the factors that influence how people vote. Just elaborate further, we find that campaign promises and service delivery forms one part. Other important parts include the intangibles, you know, how well they cater to the ethnic and regional interests of the communities to make sure that they have adequate political representation and that they are making sure that projects are being delivered to the ground. I think that's fairly important, and how well issues are being championed. So when we take it as a whole, the manifesto forms maybe a smaller part in terms of what goes into a voter's mind and when they make the calculus of choosing the particular candidate or party on the ballot paper.
That was Ben Sufian, founder of independent pollster Merdeka Centre, on his thoughts on the recently launched Barisan National Manifesto.
I have to say that last comment about, you know, whether we, as you know, as people, actually pay attention to what's in these manifestos. I have to say, Sharad, it's for me, I just don't see the point of manifestos. There are so many manifestos right now. One for youth, one for women, one for this state and that state, and catering for different, the wants and needs of different people, which I get, right? Not everyone, it's not a one size fits all, but how many of us actually go into a manifesto and read it thoroughly?
Right, and I think that's very, very important right now. To be fair, execution risk of these manifestos will be evident on both sides, right? But at least knowing the plans that they intend to roll out if they form the federal government post GE14, I think that is something that as informed and engaged voters, sure, as you mentioned earlier, right? When it comes to political engagement, it constitutes making sure that you go through these manifestos and find what's applicable to you.
How many of us remember what was in the GE13 manifesto? Can you point out what was there, apart from, you know, the broad areas of affordable housing and cost of living?
So for example, they talked about reducing the prices of cars, which have come down considerably. They talked about abolishing tolls interstate or intercity, I can't remember which one now. So there were only because I had to cover that that manifesto launch.
Oh,
as
you
well
covered it.
previous gig.
But you know, answer mine. So the politicians will come out and say that they have fulfilled many of their election promises, and I believe caretaker Prime Minister Najib Razak came out and sort of said, well, you know, we've achieved about 97% or so. We can check the details of that, but that he said. So he made the claim that the question is who's watching these claims,
right?
Yeah, I do think, Melissa, though, very quickly, that I think that manifesto is important in terms of aspirations. But what you see is when you look at the compare the two manifestos, they don't seem very different in style. That, you know, as Ben said, they're a laundry list of promises, not a vision that's coherent.
One quick difference, though, very, very big difference, Pakatan's plan to abolish GST. In my view, game changer.
Okay.
Maybe not for the best.
We'll be back with more. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.